You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In the late hours of July 22, 1991, Detective Patrick Pat Kennedy of the Milwaukee Police Department was asked to respond to a possible homicide. Little did he know that he would soon be delving into the dark mind of one of America's most notorious serial killers, the Milwaukee cannibal, Jeffrey Dahmer. As the media clamored for details, Kennedy spent the next 6 weeks, 16 hours a day, locked in an interrogation room with Dahmer. There, the 31-year-old killer described in lurid detail how he lured 17 young men to his apartment where he strangled, sexually assaulted, dismembered, and in some cases, cannibalized his victims. In Grilling Dahmer, the interrogation of the Milwaukee cannibal, the reader is taken on a horrifying tour into the mind of evil as Kennedy patiently, meticulously, listened to unspeakable horrors so that a monster would be taken off the streets forever. The book we're featuring this evening is Grilling Dahmer, The Interrogation of the Milwaukee Cannibal, with my special guest, journalist and author, Robin Maharaj. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Robin Maharaj.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Thank you so much. With this book, Grilling Dahmer, why don't you tell our audience how you came to be involved with Patrick Kennedy and ultimately involved with this incredible story?
Well, quite a few years ago, probably back about almost 8-9 years ago, I was working as a freelance writer. I always had a full-time job, but I was always, you know, sort of hungry to be writing all the time. And so I was working as a freelance writer. And I guess it was around the time I turned 40, and I thought, you know, I've been sort of tackling lots of different topics. And it's fabulous because you do get to learn about a lot of different things. But I kind of got to a point where it's like, you know what, I just really want to focus on the things that I'm really interested in and I kind of feel like I know a lot about. So true crime, of course, was one of those things. And I thought, I'm just going to try and tackle an article and write a true crime article and just sort of see how it goes. So I chose Jeffrey Dahmer because I had seen something listed and it was kind of like, you know, the top 10 most evil people in history. And for whatever reason, Dahmer was number 3. So there was like Stalin, Hitler, Dahmer. And I was like, I know he was a bad guy. I know he did some really monstrous things, but really, was he the most, you know, third most evil person in the history of the world? So it kind of made me want to explore him a little bit and do some, you know, background check on him and research a little bit more about the case. I mean, I was familiar, obviously, with who Jeffrey Dahmer was. And I knew sort of the highlights of the story and the crimes that he had been, had been charged with and eventually was in prison for. But I didn't really know that much about him. So I decided I wanted to do an article about him. And one of the reasons that I kind of felt a little bit of the difference between him and sort of other killers that, you know, you've profiled in books on your show, is I just sort of felt like, you know, this is a guy who he was killing, but it was really a means to an end because he was really a necrophiliac and he really just wanted those bodies. And ultimately, really, what he really wanted was companionship. He wanted a person. He wanted somebody there to be with him because he'd never really experienced love. He didn't really like conflict. He didn't really like confrontation. So he didn't really want a true partner, someone that, you know, he could be conversing with and, you know, challenging him at all. He just really wanted somebody there who he could talk to and do things with. So, but I felt, you know, his place of coming was really out of a place of love, out of a place of need and loneliness. So to me, I thought that's something I want to explore. So I contacted a few people and eventually I found myself in touch with Patrick Kennedy through email. And he seemed to be kind of interested in my take on it. And he said, you know, I have notes and reports and different things that I've kept over all these years. Maybe it'll help you. So as it turned out, he became a source for my interview and I ended up going down to Wisconsin Johnson. I met with him. We did the interview. He showed me all of these notes and everything that he had, and we even talked about possibly collaborating on something, a book together. My goal was that, you know, this is his story, and he just needs some assistance to kind of get it through to fruition, finished, and then maybe to be looked at by a publisher. But as it turned out, 5 days after we met in Wisconsin, Patrick had a heart attack and died. And so I did eventually go on with my article. I sent it to his widow, and she said, you know, you did a really nice job here, and I think that you kind of had an understanding of how Patrick felt about Dahmer. Why don't you just take the notes, take whatever you have there, and just see what you can do with it. If it becomes a book, great. But she wasn't really prepared to do anything. Like, she didn't have the experience. I don't think she really even had the ambition or the drive necessarily to turn this into a book. She said it'll probably just go into a desk drawer otherwise, you know. So with that, I said, you know, not only is this an interesting story that should really be told, but it's also now kind of a legacy for Kennedy, because to me, he was a detective who just happened to be responsible for interrogating one of the most notorious serial killers in American history. But really, Patrick, had an interesting story as well.
Yeah, so you talk about his background, fourth-generation police officer, and then his rise in the police ranks itself till that point when he was slated for the interrogation of Jeffrey Dahmer by his lieutenant at that time. And what you, after he died and then you corresponded with his widow, really what you were left with was the description, the total description of Jeffrey Dahmer's confession, but also his complete interaction, as he was the main detective, along with another detective, but he was absolutely the main detective in interrogating Jeffrey Dahmer. So what you did have from Patrick Kennedy's widow was essentially how he did this, what Jeffrey Dahmer had said, and he was able to obtain identification of all the victims with Jeffrey Dahmer's cooperation. And identification and details about all of the murders to corroborate his confession that Patrick Kennedy elicited from him.
Dahmer very quickly felt a rapport, obviously, with Kennedy and said, you know, I'll talk, but I only want to talk to you. And so there was something there that I think it was just Patrick saying, you know, like, hi, you know, like introduced himself, and he wasn't going to rough him up. Like, there was a couple of other detectives who had kind of tackled him because they realized, you know, we've got somebody here who seems to be dangerous. And this is all, of course, in Dahmer's apartment. By the time Kennedy, who was a plainclothes detective, showed up, you know, he'd been sort of wrestling with the cops a little bit. He was handcuffed, and they got him up. And I think he was just like a friendly face all of a sudden. And Dahmer even said, are you going to beat me up too? And Patrick said, no, I know, I'm just gonna hang out with you for a little bit, and then we're gonna take you downtown, and then I wanna talk to you. I wanna hear what you have to say.
Tell us a little bit more about Patrick Kennedy's background concerning his religious upbringing, and before we talk about his assignment to interrogate Jeffrey Dahmer and his plan on how he would interrogate him.
Well, Patrick was a Catholic, and I mean a Catholic, I think, all through his life, right up to the end of his life. And, you know, I think he was a practicing Catholic. He found a lot of solace in the church. And in fact, even before, you know, he was embarking on any kind of career when he was a young man, or, you know, like late teens, early 20s, trying to decide what he wanted to do with his future, he really contemplated actually becoming a priest. You know, he was that involved with the Catholic Church. I think he actually did some scholarship stuff with a religious school that he went to and attended. So he was really, you know, very, very involved in the Catholic Church. Patrick had a drinking problem. Like, he was an alcoholic. And so when it came time where he decided, okay, I'm just going to, you know, I want to beat this, I want to get past this, it was really through the church. Like, he went through a counseling kind of program through that was offered to the church. So it was a really important part of his life, you know, I would say. I think the idea of the confessional, I think, was important to Patrick, and I think that idea of making it, you know, a place of sort of comfort for that person. I mean, no matter what it is that they're confessing to, you know, just kind of be there and say, like, I'm not here to judge you, I'm just here to listen to what you have to say. That was definitely the way that Kennedy kind of, I think, became sort of a somebody that Dahmer could or felt that he could talk to. Because we're talking about Dahmer, who most people who knew him, the few people that knew him and those that knew him really well, would say, you know, under any kind of type of pressure or authority where, you know, he felt he was being confronted, he would just shut down. Like, he just would not talk. He had nothing to say to anybody, and that was it. So the idea that Patrick could say, well, you know, do you want some coffee? How about a cigarette? Have you eaten at all, you know, lately? Can we get you a sandwich? Like, this was all sort of a humane thing that Patrick was doing, and that I think Dahmer responded to. Patrick knew as well, because of him being an alcoholic or recovering alcoholic himself, very quickly recognized in Jeff, like, this guy, I think, has got a drinking problem. Like, when he showed up, like, when he came to the police station, I think he was just sobering up from an evening and night of drinking. And I think Patrick recognized that right away and said, you know, do you think you have a drinking problem, Jeff? And Jeff said, yeah. And Patrick said, you know, this is something that we can talk about. So between religion and sort of, is there a God, and what role does God play in your life, plus alcoholism and sort of the effects that that has had in terms of, you know, decisions and things that he would make. I think for Dahmer's, in Dahmer's case, it kind of gave him energy, or kind of gave him confidence and some courage a little bit. And often he would say, when it came to dismembering bodies and the things that he was doing, he'd often have to be very drunk in order to be able to do that. So they sort of connected along the way. But Patrick, before he became a police officer, he did come from a family of cops, but he actually went into social work first. And he was working with ex-convicts, and they were doing a program where they were working on houses. So they were teaching these guys skills like construction and electrical work and plumbing, and then they would fix up houses in Milwaukee, sell them, use the money that they made, and buy another house that needed some work on. And so this was to give these guys like something to do, something that wasn't criminal, and also to teach them some skills. So he did that for quite a long time. But his family was growing. He got married very young. He had his first child when he was very young, like 19, 20 years old. So by the time his third child came along, and we're talking Catholic private schools, he needed a better career. He needed a career that was going to pay him a little bit more money. So I think that's when he decided to join the police force. And he also kind of felt like, you know, I know the scheduling. I know how it works. I know what it looks like to be a cop because, again, his father was a police officer. So he kind of knew what was expected of him. And, so he very quickly, like, I mean, I think he went up the ranks and became a homicide detective pretty young. When he encountered Dahmer for the first time, Pat was 37.
Mm-hmm. You talk about this July 22nd, 1991, and anybody that's ever followed any true crime story or Jeffrey Dahmer story knows, so we don't have to go through it again, but this is Tracy Edwards is found by police, so he flags down police with a handcuff around one arm, and he doesn't really, he just wants to get unhandcuffed,
mm-hmm.
and so he directs the police to the nearby apartment of Jeffrey Dahmer, and he doesn't want any criminal charges, he just wants the key to the handcuffs, and Jeffrey Dahmer can't produce that, so there's a scuffle with police after they take a look around. They see some Polaroids of dismembered people, and so while they're going through, Milwaukee Police Department is going through there, and the first thing they do is they look in the fridge, and they see a severed head in the fridge staring at them, but Kennedy is not at the home itself. He is interrogating Jeffrey Dahmer. So the thing is, obviously, one of the main issues always, if not the main issue, is when the issue of whether this person will ask for an attorney. So mm-hmm. obviously Dahmer says, I don't want to be uncooperative, but do you think I should get a lawyer? So what does Patrick Kennedy do? Because this is a big issue. What does he say to Jeffrey Dahmer to convince him to keep talking and not talk to a lawyer?
Well, he kind of uses his Dahmer's, you know, first statement, which is, you know, I really want to try and help you guys, and, you know, if I can help you to tell you, you know, who these guys were, help you identify. Like, he really, they were saying, this is what we need from you, and he is kind of agreeing to it. Pat actually did go to the apartment, though. He did the interrogation and everything, and he wasn't the first police officer on the scene. There were some, like, uniformed cops that were there with Tracy, but they quickly called homicide as soon as they found the head. And Pat was actually at the police station with his partner, and they were just getting ready to start their shift, and they got that call. They got that call, you got to go check out this apartment, something about a head in the freezer or fridge, and, you know, it's probably nothing, but you need to go and look at, you know, go check it out and just say that we did it kind of thing. And so that's how he ends up at the apartment. And, you know, yeah, Jeff had been kind of roughed up a little bit. He was already handcuffed, but that was actually when they first were introduced. And I think that's, too, when Dahmer kind of realized, okay, well, maybe I can talk to this guy, you know. And so he kind of stuck with him the whole time till they got to the police station. And that's when Dahmer said, you know, I'll talk, but I only want to talk to him. And so then Pat's boss said, okay, you know, you're on this guy. You're like glue. The thing about the lawyer, though, that you had asked about was, I guess somebody saw these things on the news. They saw the name Jeffrey Dahmer, and so they actually called Jeff's dad. Jeffrey was sort of saying to Pat, you know, do I need a lawyer? He was kind of hemming and hawing a little bit, not sure. I kind of want to talk to you. I kind of want to keep going here. But I guess he was realizing I'm in really hot water. But it was actually Lionel, Jeff's father, who was in Ohio, heard about what was going on and said, you know, I'm going to get a lawyer for my son. So he phoned a lawyer that they actually already had some experience with. I mean, Jeff had been in some trouble before, nothing like this, but had a lawyer before. So he got that lawyer, and he came down, and I guess this was really sort of the standoff almost, you know, the lawyer saying, I don't want my client talking anymore. They're saying, well, he didn't hire you, you know, somebody else had hired you, and we got to find out from Jeff what he wants to do. So, you know, I guess they could have said, well, your lawyer's here, maybe you better just shut up. But they really wanted to, I mean, they wanted to continue him talking, and they were doing everything they could to kind of keep him, you know, communicating with them. So they said, well, you can talk to us. I mean, you can have your lawyer here. Your rights can be, you know, looked after. But if you sign or say it on a piece of paper that you want to continue talking to us and helping us, then you don't have to go away to your lawyer. You can sit here and still talk to us. So that's what he ultimately did. Though during the interrogation, the lawyer did have his assistant sitting in through pretty much everything. Like, she was there while he was confessing.
Mm-hmm. You write, though, that he uses he talks to Jeffrey Dahmer and realizes that Jeffrey Dahmer does not want to go to the bullpen with everybody that's been arrested that night. So
right.
He says, well, you can go down there if you want. I know he realizes he doesn't want to go down there. So he says to him, you can continue talking. We can just talk about your past. We could talk about your family. So he just encouraged him to talk. So there was an interesting ploy that he did that. Now, all by himself, in that room with Jeffrey Dahmer, he used that, his Catholic upbringing, his experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. How did he use these aspects of his own personal life to be able to reach to Jeffrey Dahmer, to plead to Jeffrey Dahmer to help in this investigation? And what was that help that they actually wanted once they did get this confession from him?
Well, you know, he was using religion. He was using a little bit of family. He was using the idea of drinking. And I mean, he didn't really want to come off, and he didn't really want Jeff to be sort of suddenly thinking, hey, if I just blame alcohol, then suddenly I'm not quite so responsible. Like, he wanted him to sort of own it a little bit. But yeah, I mean, he really sort of, you know, sort of said, well, maybe this, you know, affected you. Like, maybe all this drinking and everything affected you. And it certainly, like, in terms of all of the major things that happened in Dahmer's life, like, you know, schooling and going on to college and then army, like, everything he'd washed out because he had this, you know, consistent drinking problem. So I think what Pat did was he actually shared a lot of his own story, which I can't really think of many homicide detectives that would do that. You know, like, they kind of sort of, they just want to hear from the suspect. They don't necessarily want to share anything about their own lives. But I guess for whatever reason, you know, Pat felt as though this is some way I can reach this guy. And so some of that helped, I think, in terms of just, you know, kind of using a bit of it as an excuse, some of it as, you know, a bit of, you know, having him question why he was doing what he was doing. But really, as you said, just get him talking, just kind of get him to go through each of the stories of each of the men that he met and how did he manage to convince them to come back. Because don't forget, I mean, that's essentially how he operated. He wasn't going around abducting people from the street. He was making making connections with people very quickly, McMahon, and saying, why don't you come back to my place and we'll have some drinks or we can watch a movie or whatever. And, I mean, you know, that was kind of remarkable. They needed Dahmer, though. They really needed Dahmer because back in 91, I mean, sure, DNA was accessible, but not nearly as accessible as it is now.
No.
And they didn't necessarily know, you know, I mean, they didn't have like a list of potential victims because people had, I mean, some people had maybe been reported missing, but I don't think the Milwaukee police really took those missing reports all that seriously because I think they looked at these photos of these very strong, healthy looking men and saying, well, you know, whoever this guy tangled with, I'm sure this person, you know, was the one that came out successful. They just didn't think of these as potential victims, whereas Dahmer was making them very docile. He was giving them drinks, but they were laced with drugs. So these guys were very docile and willing to kind of just, you know, be a victim for Dahmer. But, yeah, they needed Dahmer to identify those people because between photographs and what Dahmer was telling them about dates, he was actually pretty good about remembering, oh, I remember meeting this guy at the mall, you know, it was summertime, and this is basically the ruse that I used to get him to come back to my apartment.
Mm-hmm. Let's use an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages, Robin. We were talking about the ploys and the techniques that Patrick Kennedy employed to get this incredible confession, to be able to identify all of the victims in the end. And it took, like you say, the 6 weeks speaking to him every day. One of the things that was instrumental was what Jeffrey Dahmer felt when speaking to Patrick Kennedy. He did not want to... he didn't want Patrick Kennedy to feel Patrick Kennedy to judge him. And so Patrick Kennedy used a non-judgmental attitude towards everything that Jeffrey Dahmer said. And even some of the times, as you write in this incredible detailed confession, that there was times he had to walk out of that room and didn't even believe what he was being told till he got confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest thing that he used was that non-judgmental attitude. And when Jeffrey looked at him or his partner later on, they had that look of not the disgust that they probably would feel, that they just had
mm-hmm.
this non-judgmental attitude.
Yeah, like I think it was, you know, like everything that he was telling them, you know, from the point of like, oh, I started to skin the victims, or I was, you know, taking the bones away, or I decided, you know, like I really like this victim, so I wanted to experiment with eating this, you know, eating them. I mean, I can only imagine what these detectives were thinking, because I'm sure on the one hand they thought this guy's crazy, and I mean he's just, you know, making up these stories. But as you know, and as they found out from, you know, medical examiner and sort of what they were finding in the apartment, because of course once they got him, you know, secured at the police station, they were starting to go through this apartment. Dahmer didn't even realize that right away. You know, he kind of sat up in his chair. You mean they're going to my apartment now? You know, and it's like, well, of course, we found a severed head in your fridge. We got to find out what else is there. But yeah, I mean, it was just like, you know, incredible. Like just when you sort of think, okay, well, it couldn't possibly get any worse than this, it somehow did. But yeah, they kept it professional. They kept it very, you know, calm, soothing. And I mean, partly it was Jeff. Like, I mean, he wasn't a belligerent, rude suspect. I mean, he was actually very polite. You know, he was, you know, kind of engaging. They, you know, they tried to point out a little bit when he sort of had a bit of a sense of humor. You know, I mean, he wasn't an unpleasant person to have to spend. I mean, what he did was unpleasant, but I mean, he himself was actually, you know, kind of just an ordinary guy. So probably wouldn't have gone quite so smoothly had he just said, you know, F the cops, I'm not talking to anybody, and, you know, like started lying to them, you know, or telling them, exaggerating, or maybe sort of not giving all the information. I mean, he did kind of omit things occasionally, but I mean, he always came forward with the truth. You know, if they asked him about something, then he would tell them. But as you said, you know, he was kind of worried. I mean, after all was said and done, he was kind of worried about what they would think of him.
Mm-hmm. In this incredible interrogation, Jeffrey Dahmer at some point gets real relaxed, and Detective Murphy and Patrick Kennedy listen to these incredible stories. But, of course, they want to go chronologically through all of his victims. So he starts with June 1978 in Ohio, and he talks about being pulled over by an officer with garbage bags in the back seat. And he's not really pulled over any specific reason, but the officer, this Richard Munsey, is questioning him. So in this interrogation, Jeffrey Dahmer is telling them about an officer in Ohio in 1978 that pulls him over. So tell us just a little bit more about this story that probably many people know, but also that Patrick Kennedy, once he hears this, needs to get verification of this story. So tell us just a little bit about the victim and then the verification of this incredible story.
Sure. Well, there in June, this would have been around the time that Jeff was graduating from high school, he was basically on his own. He was living in Ohio. He was living in this very nice house that his parents had. His parents were in the process of divorcing. They'd been kind of separated, and they were in the process of divorcing. His father had actually moved on with another woman who then became Jeffrey's stepmother, and in fact, they were married for a very, very long time afterwards. But his mom, she ended up taking the younger brother to Wisconsin. She wanted to go and be a little bit closer to her family. So here's Jeff in Ohio, and, you know, he's like 18, 19 years old. And I always suspected that he kind of arranged this a little bit, that I think his mom, who was so upset with his dad, said, you know, like, call your father and tell him that we're gone and that you're on your own here. I don't think he did that right away. I think he kind of just said, you know, I kind of like being in this household by myself. There was access to booze. He could kind of come and go as he wanted. No one was really putting any pressure on him. So he was sort of living in this house for several weeks before his dad came and then discovered that he was living on his own and wondering where, you know, why he didn't call for sooner. But anyways, while this period of time was that he was on his own, he had been out driving and he picked up a hitchhiker, and there was a young man named Stephen Hicks, and he was actually on his way to a music festival, but he had his thumb out, and so Jeff picked him up and they started chatting, and he said, why don't you come back to my house? I've got booze there. We can maybe smoke a little pot, whatever, and just kind of hang out, listen to music, kind of hang out for a while. So this guy went along with it. And so I think Jeff was quite attracted to the guy, and, you know, they were having conversations about school, about summer, music, whatever, and drinking and just kind of hanging out and partying a little bit. Well, eventually this guy said, you know, I got to go because I want to get back onto the highway and continue on to my music festival. And Jeff didn't want him to go. He didn't want him to leave. So they ended up wrestling around and kind of fighting a bit. And Jeff picked up a barbell handle, so the metal part of the barbell, and struck this kid in the head. And so he, of course, was unconscious. And then Jeff, I think he did some things, first of all, and then he ended up strangling this young man. And he was quite freaked out. You know, of course, this was his first time ever doing anything like this. And so he was, you know, I think, on the one hand, very sexually excited, but at the same time, he was also terrified because what happens if somebody finds out? So he ended up destroying this young man. He cut up the body, and there was into body parts, and he put these body parts into these big bags. And one night, very late, he was out driving, and this cop, this Officer Munsey, pulled him over. And I think the reason he actually stopped him was because it was like a quiet kind of country road, and there was this one car that was kind of not really swerving, but it was kind of just not driving all that straight. So the guy thought, probably some teenager who's been drinking, I better pull him over. So sure enough, it was Jeff, and, you know, he was a young teenager. And so he said to him, you know, have you been drinking tonight, young man? And Jeff said, well, way earlier I was hanging out with a friend and we had a couple of beers, but, you know, I'm not drunk now. And so the officer sort of had his flashlight, and he's looking in the car, and he's like, what's with all these bags in the back seat? So Jeff, very quickly, thinking on his feet, said, well, actually, it's their garbage bags, and that's where I'm headed now. I wanted to go to the dump. My mom asked me to do this earlier, and I'd forgotten, and she's really upset right now because she and my dad are going through a divorce, and I just thought this would kind of cheer her up if I kind of, you know, did something that she had asked. So kind of a lame excuse, I guess, but anyways, somehow, with the charm and the politeness, whatever, Jeff was able to sell this story. So the guy basically said, well, you know what, the dump is closed, you can't leave bags outside, so you better just head home. He did take the license plate information and the license, you know, of Jeff down on a notepad or whatever, but he basically just sent him on his way, no ticket, no citation, just a warning. And so Jeff made it home, and I guess he was so terrified about the idea of maybe being caught again that he actually unpacked all these bags, and he crushed the bones and the body as much as he possibly could, and then he scattered what he could in the backwoods behind this house in Ohio. So there was kind of a woodsy area, so he just kind of like put the body out there. And so fast forward 13 years or so, and we're now in 1991. Jeff's been arrested, and he's in custody, and he's explaining to the detectives these victims and sort of how it all unraveled in terms of how he managed to find these men in Milwaukee. But he did say, I had this earlier killing which happened in Ohio. So he went through and he told them the whole story. So they said, well, we're going to have to bring somebody from Ohio just to verify, because they wanted to go through in Ohio missing records, you know, as far as missing men from that era, from the late 70s, and to see how many people could fit that description. So this detective from Ohio, during this period of time when the detectives in Milwaukee are talking to Jeff, they bring this detective in, and he's got photos, and they're out on the table, and he's showing Dahmer, and Dahmer picks him out right away. He said, this is the guy right here, Stephen Hicks. And so that's kind of how they identified that one. And when he was describing with this officer from Ohio exactly what happened, you know, like, I killed him, and then I tried to get rid of the body in these garbage bags. I got stopped, and then I ended up just going home and scattering the bones and the body parts in my backyard. The officer who had come from Ohio later was talking with the two detectives and said, you know what, that was me. I was the detective that stopped him. And it was actually Muncie that they, in 1991, sent from Ohio to Wisconsin to either verify or discredit what this guy was telling them. So they were kind of, Murphy, Patrick's partner, was said, you know, hey, you could have stopped this way back in 1979, and the guy was horrified, of course, but Kennedy very wisely, I think, and very kindly said to him, you know what, he's lied and he fooled a lot of people, so don't feel too bad. But when they did go back to Ohio and they searched the grounds of the backyard of this house where Dahmer had lived as a young, teenager, they did find, actually, the remains after all those years, and they actually found a little piece of a retainer that belonged to the victim. So between that, they were able to go to the family, who for 13 years had no idea what happened to their son, their brother, their cousin. Just, he went off to a music festival and just disappeared and never heard from again. Well, they finally were able to get the answers as to what happened and confirmed that he, in fact, was a victim back in 1978.
Yes, and that's incredible. Also, May 26, 1991, again, anyone that has ever looked at this Dahmer story is aware of this 911 call. A woman calls to report a young man naked, beaten up, can't stand up, needs help. Meanwhile, she gives this young man, she thinks is a boy, a windbreaker to cover up. Two teen girls come over as well, and the police officers come and basically don't really appreciate so much of the women telling them what to do or what they should look at, and they try to question the boy, but he is slurring his words. He can't really communicate to the police officers. And then Jeffrey Dahmer comes on the scene, walking with a six-pack, and waltzes into this crowd of people and tells the police that it's his boyfriend, and certainly he's not young, and he's in his 20s, and he's a boyfriend, and often, this has happened before, he's naked and drunk and runs out of the apartment and he's had to go get him. So the police, despite the women trying to intervene, go back to the apartment. And so Dahmer was able to convince them that it was his boyfriend by showing them photos of this consenting person in various provocative poses. He couldn't find the identification, but the police officers seemed to be impatient, or at least it seemed that Jeffrey Dahmer's explanation made a lot of sense, and they released this intoxicated, or this young boy slurring his words,
who had been drugged,
not realizing that he was not realizing he was a boy and thinking he was an adult, and then they left. And of course, the famous conversations with the 911 officer and also the dispatcher, for everyone to know that they were very callous about the event. Also, though, but May 26, 1991, very much like the June 1978, when Patrick Kennedy and Detective Murphy are listening to these confessions, he's horrified to realize that again, these police officers released this Laotian boy back to the clutches of Jeffrey Dahmer. So
basically helped
book,
him back to the apartment and right back into the hands of a serial killer, yeah.
Yeah. And so Patrick has, again, he's horrified because he knows that he's going to have to, someone is going to have to confront these police officers, and this kind of information is going to be released, and these police officers are going to have to, well, they will realize what they did that evening, won't they?
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So this kind of confirmation, yeah. And you talked about Patrick Kennedy, too, keeping Jeffrey Dahmer talking during this interview. And Jeffrey did not want to talk to other people. There was, as you write, many or a couple times when there was people, FBI agents wanted to talk to them. The attorney Boyle had sent his assistant, Wendy Patricus, and Patrick Kennedy did an admirable job in telling her, well, he hasn't requested for an attorney, so we're not going to let you talk to him. We're not finished with our investigation. But then as you write, a far more experienced, her boss, Attorney Boyle, comes down to the police station, and you write about how Patrick Kennedy deals with this attorney and his request to speak to his client. Tell us how Patrick Kennedy deals with this attorney and what this attorney actually gets as a result. Maybe not what he wanted.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that Boyle was basically just, you know, like, get my client out of there, you know, arrest him if you're going to, but I just don't want you talking to him anymore. And they basically just said, you know, he's grown. Like, I mean, you know, yeah, you got a call from the dad, and you know him. He has been a client of yours previously for some other, you know, infractions that Jeff had done. But, you know, like, he's willing to talk to us, and we are going to continue questioning him. And so I think Boyle, you know, I mean, he was really upset and frustrated, and you know, I mean, of course, they don't know all yet that's sort of coming. I mean, it's just sort of starting to unfold, so they don't really even know yet how bad it's getting. I mean, they just know it's bad, but they don't necessarily know the number of victims and what exactly Jeff was doing with these victims, and you know, how many close calls there had been, you know, where Jeff maybe could have been caught earlier. You know, they don't know any of that yet. So, I mean, I think Pat just really stood his ground, and I mean, personally, he knew, like, I think I can get through to this guy. I think I can talk to Dahmer, and I can get him to confess to me. He likes me. He's expressed, you know, like, when I leave the room, he's, where are you going? Are you coming back? Like, he's very much, there was something there, like there was a rapport there, and Pat was not just going to let the lawyer kind of come in and do his singing and dancing and whisk away the client. He was just determined that this is gonna happen, because Dahmer wanted to talk to the police. He said he seems like he's ready to confess. So they did agree that somebody, like some legal representation, should be in the room. The Dahmer went along with that, as did the detectives as well. And I guess from that point of view, it was like, you know, we want to make sure that when this case, whatever happens, goes to court, we want to make sure that, you know, we haven't violated Jeff's rights. But they didn't. I mean, he said, I want to continue talking to you. I know my lawyer's here. I know he wants me to stop talking and to shut up, but I want to keep talking. And he said, I want to help. Like, at this point, I'm caught. There's really nothing I can do. I know I'm going to be going away for life. I want to help to identify who these guys were. And don't forget, you know, at this point, Dahmer is kind of like coming out of this, you know, boozy, drunken state. You know, he is sort of starting to realize, like, the implication of what's going to happen. And once he knows they're going through my apartment, all of my secrets are going to come out. You know, like, he was basically I'm gonna do what I can to make amends as soon as I can. You know, there's really nothing he could do to fully, you know, be forgiven for what he had done, not by the victim's families or anything. But I mean, at least he could do, I guess, he felt, was to identify who the victims were.
Well, we kind of skip over the brilliance of Patrick Kennedy planting these ideas in Jeffrey Dahmer's head, to the point where he leaves the room and comes back, and Jeffrey Dahmer says, you know, basically, I think I know how to make amends, you know, after he planted these ideas, that the only way to make amends, to really, again, to do something favorable out of this situation that was horrible, was to identify the victims for the families so that they could have that peace of mind. And so he agreed to that, but Patrick planted all of these ideas for that something beneficial could happen from this. And what I also, which you don't really write about, but we have to realize that Patrick Kennedy is a handsome man. He's 6'7" and 265 pounds with, as you write, a very gentle nature.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jeffrey Dahmer, in this interrogation, it's incredible how, again, this vicious, remorseless, psychopathic killer is very vulnerable and childlike in that room. Even though he's an articulate, intelligent man, he is very vulnerable. And Patrick Kennedy at least uses that fact to be able to reach Jeffrey Dahmer at first when, like you said, he was in a sort of a drunken stupor still. And then he kept coming out of it, and they kept feeding him coffee and cigarettes. And as you write as well, that cigarettes and coffee were, again, part of the motivation, Jeffrey Dahmer thinking that he had a nicotine addiction. So cigarettes and coffee and later on donuts and just a non-judgmental, even friendly discourse many times. And as you write, too, that when he was writing out the confession, when they wanted to get all of the details so they were able to identify the victims, that those details, those incredible details were forthcoming for Jeffrey Dahmer. He acted, you write, or Patrick writes, that it was like therapy to him. He seemed like he was talking to a therapist during this entire, again, many, many weeks of interrogation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you kind of have to think like all of this is kind of kept inside Dahmer, and you know, regardless of what you think of him in terms of as a person, I mean, you know, there must have been some sort of, I mean, he must have known, okay, well, I'm done. I mean, I'm going to be in prison and that's it. I'm never going to see the light of day. And I also have to live with what I've done. People are going to be referring to me as a monster. My family, you know, they're going to be affected because of the last name and that connection. You know, they're always, Dahmer, are you related to Jeffrey Dahmer? And, you know, so, I mean, there was definitely, I think there must have been some relief in a way for Dahmer to just be able to kind of like get it all out, you know, like, I mean, probably he, in the worst way, he never thought he'd ever have to, or he wouldn't want to do that. But I think in that particular interrogation room with that particular detective, it worked. I mean, Jeff could have also, I mean, he could have shut down. That was sort of one option. The other one is that, you know, he was a very, like, kind of a charming guy. Like, he could be charming when he wanted to, very polite, you know, yes sir, no sir, very deferential. And I mean, he could have just like said all these nice things to Kennedy, but lied. You know, I mean, that's how he managed to get away with, you know, the cop in Ohio and the cops on the street with the young Laotian boy and other people where he was, you know, parole officers in the past and other people where he was able to just kind of like, hey, everything's A-okay, nothing to see here, nothing to worry about here. You know, and I mean, because he was just sort of a nice guy, they all kind of thought, you know, if anything, he was boring and bland, you know, as far as they were concerned. Like, nothing, this guy is not capable of really anything, you know, other than some of these little skirmishes and things that he had been involved with previously. So I always think it's a fine line, because I know a few people have said to me, well, you know, I mean, once they had him, I mean, what else was he going to do? Of course he was going to confess. Not necessarily. He could have shut down. He also could have just lied and lied and lied, you know, and just denied it all, you know. But I mean, not only was he confessing, there was one charge that they ended up dropping, they had a victim, they had a name, and he had actually identified somebody, but they couldn't find anything of this victim. Like in the cases of the other victims, there was either a skull or there was a driver's license or there was something that belonged or was part of the victim that they could say, okay, he's guilty and he killed this person because we have something of that person. Well, there was one victim that they had absolutely nothing of that person. And so they decided, you know what, we're not going to charge him for that because we really, you know, if it should come that, you know, he appeals or whatever, that could cause a problem later on because we don't really have any evidence of this. So he was actually confessing to crimes that he had committed where they really couldn't have pinned anything on him because they had no, truly had no evidence other than just his words. But they attempted a few times, you know, they sort of thought this seems a little too easy, you know, like he's just kind of forthcoming and whatever it is we're asking him, he's telling us. And so they did attempt to try and trick him a couple times just to see if they could catch him in a lie, something that they knew that they didn't think he knew that they knew. And but every single time they tried to catch him or get him in a lie, he, you know, he surprised them. He was actually really, really brutally honest.
Jesus has an opportunity to stop for a second for our sponsor, which is Ritual. We deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why, especially when it comes to something we take every day. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin is formulated with high-quality nutrients in bioavailable forms your body can actually use. What you won't find? Sugars, GMOs, major allergens, synthetic fillers, and artificial colorants. Plus, the fresh taste and delayed-release capsule design make taking your vitamins easy. I chose to take Ritual Essential for Men 50-plus about 6 months ago when it became available for men and teens. I decided to try it because my wife Lisa has been taking Ritual Essential for Women for over a year, and she was impressed with the results of taking Ritual daily. She felt it made a significant difference in her health, and I wanted to experience Ritual for myself. Their research into a bioavailable vitamin and mineral sources sold me on Ritual. Ritual is the multivitamin reimagined. A multivitamin should contain key nutrients and forms your body can actually use to help fill gaps in the diet with no shady extras. Ritual's delayed-release capsule design delivers high-quality nutrients, including vitamin D3, in just 2 daily pills. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping always. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. And if you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. Get key nutrients without the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. Now, we're talking about some of the things that Jeffrey Dahmer was saying in this interrogation, this brilliant interrogation by Patrick Kennedy. He had gained Jeffrey Dahmer's trust. We mentioned that there was times when they were asking questions, but this was further on in the investigation when they discovered that there was body parts in the fridge. And so they wanted to ask him about those body parts, about the idea, the notion that he would be eating some of his victims. And they asked him why he hadn't told them, why he hadn't divulged this material earlier. What was Jeffrey Dahmer's response to that question?
Well, basically, he was concerned that they would think less of him somehow, that he didn't want to admit that he'd been cannibalizing some of the victims. You know, he just thought that that was just too horrible and that they would probably start to judge him or that they wouldn't want to talk to him anymore and that, you know, that was the end of that. So he didn't admit that right away. He didn't tell them that. But when the medical examiner started talking to the detectives and saying, you know, like, based on what he's telling you about numbers of victims and what we're finding, there's some discrepancy here. Plus, we're finding, like, cuts of body parts in the fridge wrapped up, like, in butcher block paper, like it's meat. And they weren't really finding a lot of food in the fridge, mostly just these packages. So I guess they kind of came to that conclusion. So they did ask him about that and said, you know, there's something else happening. Were you doing this? And then he did admit it. But he was kind of concerned that they were going to just say, okay, that's it. We're done with you. And, you know, that would just be really too much, that he'd gone too far.
Mm-hmm. Now, also, they asked about the boxes of muriatic acid. He also had this 57-gallon blue plastic, what can you call it, bin? Not a bin.
Drum or container, yeah.
Drum, mm-hmm. Yeah, container, yeah, yeah, in his room. But they asked him about the muriatic acid, but they also found a drill and drill bits. So now, in this interrogation, there's also talk of what he does with the drill.
Right. Well, they found these tools, and then they also had found, like, he had, Dahmer had this kind of a weird idea of eventually kind of building a bit of a shrine. He even had pictures that he drew out for them and that he had had in, I guess they found in his notes, where, you know, he had sort of envisioned this, you know, big black chair, almost kind of like Darth Vader, you know, esque, and then he had these, like, skulls that were going to be kind of lined up. Some of them were going to be painted. Some of them were going to be natural. But he had this all kind of figured out, and so they did notice, though, in some of these skulls that there were holes in them that had been where a drill had been used. So they said, you know, what's that about? And he said that initially, before he actually was killing victims, what he really had wanted to do was to basically incapacitate a man that he liked and basically keep that person with him so they would kind of be half dead, half alive, that he would drill something and pour water into their brain and it would just kind of like just make them not be able to talk, communicate, fight, you know, whatever, that they were just going to be. He could lead them around the apartment, if you will. He could sit them in a chair. He could come home from work, tell him about his day. He could, you know, fix dinner while they're sitting, the victim's sitting there, you know, and, you know, then he put them to bed and then he could do things to the body. He didn't really want a dead body. He wanted an incapacitated body. But the few times that he did try this, it didn't work. Like one person he was actually able to keep alive for quite a few hours. But when he got home, he had laid out this person on a bed and that by the time he got home, this person had died. So he was unsuccessful in what he was trying to do with this drilling of, you know, drilling in holes in the head. But it, essentially what I called it or what I referred to it as, he wanted like a zombie boyfriend. You know, he wanted somebody that he could love, that he could feel would be affectionate to him, that but he could basically just sort of manipulate and do with what, that person whatever he wanted. And but it just, that didn't work. So then he ended up going as far as drugging them and then suffocating them, and then he would be able to do whatever he wanted with the body. Because that was ultimately his goal, like as he wanted the body.
You write a very interesting thing that I've never read before, that he said that the reason he wanted to rape them and he didn't enjoy anal sex himself. He enjoyed all the other aspects, mm-hmm. the touching, the kissing, oral sex, but he didn't like anal sex, so he wanted the ability to be able to rape them and mm-hmm. do whatever he wanted with the body, but he did not want to have to reciprocate, especially that anal sex. So
that's right.
It seems like not great reasons for murder, but through this entire interrogation, Pat Kennedy gets him to ask him for his motivations. What is the motivation for keeping the heads, for example? He would ask.
Mm-hmm.
Him.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he had these kind of strange reasons for things. You know, sometimes it was, well, I really liked this victim. You know, I thought he was really sexy, and I liked his body especially. Or, there's other victims that he didn't really care so much about. So, you know, he kind of just would dispose of them, but not necessarily want to keep body parts. Maybe some other kind of little trophy just to remind himself of the encounter. But you know, he was he kept things, like he kept skulls, and as I said, he was sort of had this idea of a shrine with that. I don't think it's unusual for killers like Jeff to keep things, but in terms of his motivation, like it was kind of like what I mentioned earlier in that, you know, he wanted a very compliant partner. He also didn't want those people to leave. That was his big thing. Like I think Dahmer had a lot of issues with regard to abandonment. And even this is maybe stemming from when he was a younger person in that, you know, he was living at home with his family. His dad, he didn't come from a bad background. Like, I mean, his parents were caring. They had money. There was some wealth there, you know. So, I mean, I don't think that he and his brother kind of lacked for anything. But what they did have in terms of a family unit was a dad who was very much a workaholic, and he was very, very much involved with the work that he was doing. So he wasn't around a lot. And he also had a wife, and then therefore Jeff and his brother had a mom, who did suffer from mental illness. And so there were times when she was in a psychiatric hospital, or the times that she was at home, sometimes she was, you know, just not really available, wasn't really present because she'd be sleeping or she'd be have taken some medication. So she wasn't really, you know, the times that Jeff remembers of his parents are mostly they were fighting. You know, that was the thing that he remembered the most. But, you know, his dad was gone at different times. You know, he was either working or he was off with his girlfriend then became his wife. The mom left, you know, like she just kind of threw up her hands with this marriage and she took off with the younger son. So there was like abandonment things where people were constantly leaving him. And so when he decided, I want to try and find a partner, that was his thing, as long as they don't leave me. And so there was one instance I mentioned in the book where he met somebody who had actually come in from out of town. I think they met at a bus stop, like a Greyhound bus stop or something. And this guy was in from Chicago, and so Jeff invited him to come and stay with him, and they went, you know, and had some drinks, and they went out and did some shopping, they made dinner. I mean, they had kind of like a weekend together, almost, if you will. And I mean, Jeff said it was like the closest thing to a relationship he'd ever really had. Well, Sunday night comes, this guy's like, I got to get back to Chicago because I'm due at work tomorrow. And that's when Jeff acted. You know, he's like, I didn't want him to leave. So he said, well, have one more drink. And that's when he laced it, the guy passed out, Jeff strangled him, and that was it. He was gone, you know, never to be seen again.
What was contained in these interrogations, these confessions, though, was something not so understandable when you talk about, well, he just was a lonely guy and he wanted these people to stay with him and that's why he killed them. But there is other things that don't jive with that so much in that his sexual feelings for every bit of that dismemberment process. He talked about slicing the body open from the neck to the genitals and pulling out the viscera and sticking it on the chest. And the poor cops that had to see those photographs of this outside of the body. And also that he had a particular interest in the hearts of many of these victims as well, or at least a few of them anyway. And also just the, every bit of this, he talked about like intercourse with the viscera. So
yes, yeah. Yeah, there was some very, very strange things going on there. And I mean, that, again, that does go back to Dahmer's, you know, kind of childhood in that he was very interested in roadkill. You know, like, hey, he lived in this kind of like country type setting. And he never, as far as anyone knows, he never killed any animals. But, you know, he was very, very interested in going and picking up roadkill. He would, you know, scoop it or scrape it off the road and throw it into a bag and bring it home. And he had this kind of like shed thing that was on their property that he would go and he would take these dead animals and, you know, he would dismember them and he liked jars of different things that he would put things in and experimenting, basically, like putting acid in and seeing how long it would take for the fur and the skin to come off of, say, a cat skull and just being left with the bones. Like, he was really very interested in sort of what he called the insides of things, the insides of dead things. And a few people who, you know, talked with him, psychiatrists, psychologists, those kind of people who had that kind of experience and education were sort of thinking that, you know, like this interest in all this stuff about dead people or dead things and the insides of things kind of meshed around the time that he would have been maybe going through puberty. So somehow this sort of jived with his sexuality that he found. I mean, most people would find this completely distasteful, but I mean, he found that sexually arousing, those inside organs or those viscera pieces of the body. I mean, part of him had to be really drunk in order to do what he was doing, but I mean, that was what he was very interested in. That was what he really was interested in, was the insides of dead things, as he said.
Mm, absolutely. With this confession, through this interrogation, they were over the course of all those weeks, they were able to identify, for example, they had Munsey come with photos and to come to Milwaukee to be able to speak with Patrick Kennedy and look at the evidence that Dahmer provided, but they were able to get closure on 17 murders, thanks to Jeffrey Dahmer, weren't they?
Yeah, yeah. And as I said, you know, like this is before DNA. This is before they had a list of potential victims. You know, they were really, I think, in a lot of ways kind of shooting in the dark. They had to find photographs. They had to, you know, they did go and look through some missing people report, but they also had like mugshots, you know, and I mean, it was just kind of like really kind of a scramble to sort of figure out and piece together who these victims were, because it wasn't as, I mean, it was kind of a different story in a way. Like if you think about, say, Bundy, I mean, there were bodies, right? There were bodies that were being found, and they had women victims that were being identified, and but they didn't know who the killer was. You know, it was just these body parts, and they figured there was somebody that was out there attacking women of a certain age that looked a certain way. In Dahmer's case, like they come across Dahmer first, and then it all kind of unfolds after that, and then it's sort of trying to piece together. He's saying, oh, well, I killed a lot of men, you know, and this is kind of how I did it. And they're trying to figure out, okay, who did you kill? Who, and how do we find out who those people are? And again, at a time when DNA was just not something that they could just, you know, randomly, oh, let's get this person in, and maybe it's a relative of this person who says they're missing. You know, it was really, really more of a puzzle in terms of trying to figure out who all these folks were.
Mm-hmm.
They were actually quite amazed at Dahmer's recall in terms of, like, he could say, oh, I remember meeting this guy at this place around this time, you know, and so they were like, wow. I mean, he's actually, I mean, obviously these were meaningful encounters for Dahmer, but, I mean, he actually had a pretty good memory.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, when he talks about living at his grandma's house and at first, you know, looking for work and then also going to church with his grandma. And, you know, she was a very religious person, but on the weekends and knowing her schedule, he would meet men on Fridays, want to keep them late to Sundays, knew the trash was going out Monday. So he routinely did things like pick them up, drug them, dismembered them, destroyed them, disposed them, broke up the skeletons with a sledgehammer. He found ways of effectively disposing of his victims.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Very much so. I mean, some he kept. I mean, they were in his apartment, you know. But, I mean, between the acid drums and, you know, throwing away and flushing down the toilet some smaller pieces of body, you know, he was and cannibalizing, obviously. I mean, there was very little. I mean, aside from what they found in the apartment that he was hanging on to specifically, you know, it was a head, it was a skull, it was this bone or that bone, because he liked the look of it or the way it felt, or, you know, it was just something that meant something to him. But I mean, for the most part, he was actually able to dispose of most of his victims and have no one kind of come across it and say, oh my God, you know, I think we've got body parts here, we better call the police, and then having them investigate and figuring out, you know, like, how did this body get here and who's our perpetrator. I mean, he was not on anyone's radar. Like, I mean, there wasn't as though, I remember someone just recently saying to me, like, you know, oh, how could he have gotten away with so much when people knew there was a serial killer in their midst? It's like, they didn't know that there was a serial killer. I mean, there was these missing men, you know, that I'm sure in some cases people were reporting. But again, they were like, you know, this is a healthy young man. Like, this man's not going to get into any trouble. Like, he probably just ran off, or he decided he didn't want to live in Milwaukee anymore. You know, he's just gone. And the police didn't really do that much to sort of, I mean, they might have taken a report or whatever, but I mean, I don't think they were really searching for any of these guys. There did seem to be a little bit of knowledge within the gay community. Like, I remember reading or seeing an interview with somebody who said, you know, there would be guys that would come to these clubs, and then every once in a while be like, hey, we haven't seen so-and-so in a while, I wonder where he is. But I mean, no one really suspected that anything was going on where they were being killed. Maybe just, oh, they're probably just not hanging around here anymore. Maybe they moved, or, you know, they're just, maybe they're in a different area of the city. You know, they were able to come up with reasons why, you know, suddenly someone who was there one day was not the next.
You write that the confession that he was giving was leaked to the press by a janitor that worked in the district attorney's office. They thought it might have been Patrick Kennedy. He didn't say anything, didn't submit to any interviews. But this confession was leaked to the press, and this story, as anybody knows, was just massive because of the details that were emerging, heads in fridges and cannibalism and necrophilia get everyone's attention, and the press really exploded over this case, didn't it?
Absolutely. And because of the timing of it being occurring in like 1991, that's when he was arrested, was in July of 91, so 30 years ago this summer. Just for your information, in case you didn't do the math. But yeah, so like 30 years ago, and like at that time, that's when like CNN and some of these 24-hour news stations were just kind of kicking off, right? So I think when they saw, you know, there's a story of a potential serial killer in Milwaukee, they did. They had the world's media show up for all the reasons that you mentioned. But I think also, too, just because of that cycling, they needed stuff to be showing, you know, hour after hour, and they needed cases to follow, and they needed a story where there was going to be developments and press conferences. And so, I mean, I think this case, you know, as horrible as it was and as terrible as it was for all the family members and victims' families, you know, the news media really kind of jumped on it.
At the same time, and I remember remarking, saying this to you as well, is that Silence of the Lambs is huge and now turned into a real franchise. But Silence of the Lambs was a very, very successful book and very successful movie just months before this, you know, real life.
Yeah,
art
that's
imitates,
right.
You know, life imitates art. So.
Right, exactly. I think the movie came out in like February of 1991, and Death was caught in July. So, in fact, People magazine, the week after he was arrested, referred to it as, you know, a real-life Silence of the Lambs, Nightmare in Milwaukee. And so they really jumped on that. You know, the idea of a serial killer. And, I mean, you know, people remember the cannibalizing and the necrophilia of Dahmer. But, you know, there was a period in there where he was actually skinning some of his victims. And he had said to the detectives, you know, I thought it might be kind of cool to just wear the skin, you know. And I mean, that's not that different from what the movie, the plot of Silence of the Lambs is. So yeah, definitely people made that connection of like, wow, you know, like what is going on in terms of like this tiny little apartment in Milwaukee and all this evil that just was happening, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, Patrick Kennedy, through this whole thing, there are people, one psychologist says to him, oh no, the FBI says to him and his partner Murphy, that they were suffering from Stockholm syndrome, meaning they got too close to Jeffrey Dahmer and they couldn't be objective. Tell us what you write about the effect of this whole thing on Patrick Kennedy, but also calls for him to see a psychologist. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I think the FBI, I mean, the way that they're portrayed in the book, I think, is, you know, really much how Detective Kennedy and his partner sort of saw this, and she's like, oh, this is our case, and we don't really need these guys to come in, because they were saying all sorts of things, you know, you guys are getting too close to the suspect, you know, they were also quite amazed and thought, really put forward the idea, like, how do you know he's operating alone, like, how do you know that he doesn't have, like, a partner who's complicit in all of this, and, you know, they were making some suggestions that, you know, Kennedy and his partner couldn't really put their finger on like why that they just knew that wasn't the case. Like I guess because they felt they knew Jeff well enough to realize this guy's a loner. Like he doesn't have really any friends, and you know certainly he's not going to sort of bring a friend into what he was doing. I mean, what he was doing was all very on his own, very isolated. It was all for his own pleasure. He was a very selfish person, you know, and it was all just for meeting his own needs, even if it meant killing somebody else. So they kind of scoffed at that a little bit, you know, in terms of, and they certainly didn't feel as though they were getting too close to the suspect. I mean, they felt that they were using, I wouldn't say manipulating Dahmer, but I mean that they were sort of using things that they felt that Dahmer would respond to positively, and that they, you know, they would just sort of keep, you know, I think in a way too, like it was almost like Patrick did kind of become a friend to Jeff, maybe knowing, like, this is a guy who probably doesn't have a lot of friends, and if I kind of pretend to be his friend, you know, maybe it'll get us a little further. His wife, actually, Kennedy's wife, was quite concerned about his mental state and dealing with all of this case, and was really worried that he was going to actually become an alcoholic again, that he was going to start to drink again, even after being sober for a really long time. But he said, this case is just so awful, like I could see you being driven to drink. And Pat wasn't really worried about that, you know, but she really, oh, I want you to go to counseling, I think you should see somebody. They actually did bring in, I think, a psychiatrist or psychologist or somebody to come talk to them. But for the most part, they kind of just said, you know what, we think we can handle this, you know. I mean, it was a pretty atrocious case, but I think for the most part, they really did feel that they could handle it. The case really was with Kennedy for a long time after. In fact, I would almost say like right up until just before he died, because he and I were even discussing like maybe this could be a book someday. But yeah, I mean, for years and years afterwards, people who wanted to do an interview or to talk about Jeff and would come to the Milwaukee Police Department to say, who can we speak to? He was like the Dahmer detective. You got to go. You got to talk to Kennedy. He's the Dahmer detective. And so, you know, he was constantly sort of being asked about the case. What was Jeff really like? How did you manage to hear all of these horrible things and like not want to throttle the guy? Kennedy went on to continue his work as a police officer and a homicide detective for 10 years. So he did that, I think, up to 2001. And then he decided he wanted to go back to school. And so he went back to college and he actually became a criminologist and then started teaching other people who were wanting to go into law enforcement. But he said to me one time, he said, you know, the first week when kids would start showing up, the students would start showing up, he said, I always had like 300 students because they would say, oh my God, this is the guy, the Dahmer detective, you know. So he would say, you know, yeah, I'm going to kind of use a little bit about how we worked with Dahmer in order to solve the murders, you know, and figure out who all these people were. But it's not going to be the only thing I'm talking about. You know, there's other things that I'm going to be teaching here. So, you know, he was always kind of associated with this, you know, like he was always associated with the Dahmer case. And as I said, right up until, you know, a month before or less than a month before he passed away, he was at a film festival that I met him at in Madison, Wisconsin, and it was about, there was a documentary about the Dahmer case. So he was asked to be part of a Q&A. And then, you know, he and I were talking first about my article and then possibly working on a book together. So, I mean, this was a career-changing, life-changing case. And I always, you know, to me, the remarkable or one of the remarkable things about it is that just that idea of how like a phone call or a certain thing can happen to you and it can just change the trajectory of your life. You know, he gets this call, he and his partner, they're next up on the run. Kate, homicide, potential homicide, you guys have to go check it out. But I mean, it could have been another detective just as easily, right? But here it was Patrick, sure. And here he happened to be the right detective for this particular suspect. And then it went from there.
There was talk, and there always would be when you get somebody like this that's accused of 17 murders, that there's other jurisdictions that are interested in potentially speaking to him. One was because he did do a military term in Germany, that they might want to speak to people then in there about unsolved mm-hmm. murders and clear their books. But it was very interesting that you write how Jeffrey Dahmer responded to things like a request from Hollywood, Florida police regarding the disappearance and murder of Adam Walsh, who was found much later, just his head was found. Mm-hmm. 1981 mm-hmm. disappearance from a Sears store, which everybody knows is that John Walsh then became this victim's advocate and America's Most Wanted, the host of and producer or co-producer of that program. What was Jeffrey Dahmer's response to that there was other victims in other jurisdictions despite his confession?
Well, you know, I guess he felt as though, like, I'm telling you guys everything, you know, like I told you everything that you need to know. And, you know, all the victims that I've explained and described, you know, these are the only victims that there are. I don't think any police anywhere, if they came across a killer like him, and you know, anyone who committed more than one murder, would, and also too, like say, you know, not a domestic murder, for example, where a spouse is killing another spouse, but when it's like a stranger on stranger kind of case, I think that it's pretty much protocol that they will do a history of who that person is, all the different places that they lived and where, all the different cities that they were in and maybe visited during this period of time that they think crimes were being committed, and they will see, are there any other victims, homicides and unsolved cases where, you know, those sort of things match up in terms of, you know, the kind of victim that was profiled or certain circumstances or MOs, you know, is there anything that's similar that we can maybe see if this person happened to be there and could have potentially been responsible for that current unsolved crime. They did know that Patrick had been in Florida, and it was around that time that Adam had gone missing. And I guess because of the fact that they found a head, and then when they were investigating Jeff 10 years later, they were head related. I mean, they found a head in the fridge and they found the skulls. So they just really felt like this is a good tip. You know, we really think that we've got somebody here. So they asked him about it. They brought people from that police department to Milwaukee to sort of question Jeff and ask him about it. He was actually very offended, you know, because he said, you know, these are like, this is a little boy. This is like a six-year-old boy, because I'm only interested in men. They did point out to him that some of his victims had been, you know, mid-teen age, and but he always maintained, I thought they were older. Like, there was a 14-year-old, he thought he was like more like 18 or 19, and another one that was 17, he thought it was in his early 20s. When he saw the picture of Adam Walsh, he said, this is like a little kid, and I'm not interested in little kids.
Yes. You wrote, too, that Jeffrey Dahmer is very concerned about what Patrick Kennedy thought of him and also Detective Murphy, but also society at large and what his family would think once they discovered all the details of his murders and the other details like necrophilia. But despite that, he had received correspondence while he was in jail. Was he surprised at the celebrity itself and the kind of celebrity that he received?
To be honest, I don't really know. I mean, I guess initially it probably did surprise him a little bit, because he was coming to these interrogation meetings in the interrogation room, and he was saying, you know, I'm getting all these letters. I'm getting somebody who's asking me to review a book about another serial killer, you know. And I think after he was incarcerated, you know, he was like the most infamous prisoner they had where he was being kept. And so he was getting all these letters and everything. So I think initially probably would be the same for anybody, except for those that are really seeking out publicity. Like some serial killers really love the publicity that they get. But I mean, in Jeff's case, I think it was pretty much benign about the whole thing. But once he did start to get people wanting to correspond with him or sending pictures or saying things like, you know, like they just were interested in him because of the celebrity, I guess. But, you know, I think initially it kind of was surprising to him and puzzling. He didn't really understand it. But then as time went on, I think he kind of enjoyed it a little bit, you know. Like they said that somebody had gone to see him when he was in prison. Well, not gone to see him, but had gone to see another person in prison and happened to see Jeff when he was there. And they said, you know, he's, you know, a little bit different than when they had first met him, you know. Like he was well known in that prison. You know, people would walk by and be whispering, oh, that's Dahmer, you know, that's Jeffrey Dahmer, or hi, Jeff. You know, everyone seemed to know who he was and what his name was. For the first part of his incarceration, he was in isolation. But, you know, he was not happy in prison. I mean, he said, I deserve to be here. In fact, he felt he deserved to die for what he had done. But he said, you know, they don't have the death penalty in Wisconsin. So he was going to be facing years and years of his life in jail, probably the rest of his life in jail. And he was just, you know, like he didn't like it there. He was not happy there. So eventually he did ask to be put into the general population. And they all said to him, like the officials at the prison said, you know, it's a death sentence, Jeff. You know, you are a marked man. People don't like you here, you know, because of the celebrity, because you're so famous. You know, we don't want to do that to you. But he insisted and he said, I'll take my chances. So I think he knew that actually he was marked and that someone would eventually get him. And when he was attacked, he actually didn't have any defense wounds on him at all. And that's a very hard thing to do. If someone's attacking you with something, you know, your instinct is to stop that, right? To stop the blows. And he didn't have any marks on him, any bruises or anything. So he basically allowed himself to be beaten.
It was, you do write that he said that he had found religion in prison, found God in prison. So he continued, I guess, with the work that Patrick Kennedy did, saying that, listen, this is how you can make amends to God and to these people's, you know, victims of these families, but most importantly to God. So it seemed like Jeffrey Dahmer went along that path while he was in prison and then must have contributed to the decision for him to take himself out of protective custody, as you say, despite advice. Contrary.
Yeah, I think that in the end, you know, he did find some peace, some, you know, whatever peace he could, you know, through religion. Like he seemed to get quite involved in the, you know, with the prison chaplain there, got to know him pretty well. And I think, you know, I think that, I mean, he was very shy. Like Jeff was a very shy person, but I mean, I do think he liked to have these kind of conversations, you know, and to hear what other people thought about religion and, you know, kind of how that fit into his mindset. And you know, and I mean, I guess too, it was something to do, maybe something to focus on while he was in prison.
It's very interesting, too, when you write that Kennedy observes when Jeffrey Dahmer recalls and recounts the crimes, especially when they got him to go through chronological order and then remember everything he could. So he undertook this task very seriously. And then Patrick noticed that he would go into sort of a trance, almost reliving some of the stuff, but he would definitely sound almost robotic and be in a trance recalling what he had done so long before.
Right, almost, you know, very emotionless, really, just kind of, you know, the facts, you know, and not really sort of expressing remorse. You know, I mean, I think he was remorseful, but I don't think he really expressed it when he was describing what he was doing. It was very mechanical, the descriptions, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, the support that his family still had for him during this and then afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, his dad, I think, is probably the most visible and the most vocal in terms of support of Jeff. And you know, he kind of came out right from the beginning of, you know, very apologetic to the victims of the families and apologizing really for what his son had done. But, you know, he never stopped caring and loving his son. I think Lionel, Jeffrey's dad, Lionel Dahmer, really truly believed that there was mental illness and that, you know, he had gotten mental illness from his mom's side of the family and that had somehow affected Jeff in terms of what he became. His brother kind of disappeared. He changed his name, and as far as I know, I mean, he might keep in touch with the family, but I mean, I don't think he has anything to do with Jeff. The mom, apparently, Joyce, she was living in California. She's passed now, but she... initially, like when everything was sort of happening, when it was all unfolding in Milwaukee and they were sort of, you know, day after day discovering more and more, she retreated. She didn't really have anything to do with him at that point, but she did get in touch with him as he was proceeding to court. And then afterwards, like she would have a Sunday night or every second Sunday night calls with him once he was in prison. So she did kind of rally around and support him towards the end. Not what he did, obviously, but just in terms of, like, this is my son. And when he was killed, she said, you know, that should make everybody happy now. You know, he's been beaten to death and he's dead now. So that should, you know, that should put everybody's mind at ease. And, I mean, she was saying this in kind of a angry kind of a way, you know. I think she believed that, you know, I mean, yeah, he was, you know, he deserved to be in prison for all this time, but he didn't deserve to die the way he did.
Yeah. And so tell us just a little bit about this manuscript. Just tell us a little bit more about your interaction with Patrick Kennedy's widow and this project here, presently Growing Dahmer.
Yeah, well, after I had done this article, this is after, you know, Pat had passed away. He had a heart attack at home, and he was by himself, actually, because the widow that I'm talking with, her name is Patricia. This is actually Patrick's second wife, so this is not the wife that he was married to during the time that he was investigating Dahmer. That was his first wife and the mother of his three children. But this second wife, Patty, is the one that I was dealing with. And so after Patrick's passing, I had sent her a message just, you know, really expressing my shock and remorse and you know, sadness that she had lost him so suddenly, so abruptly. He was only 59 years old. He had just had, like, a little bit ago, maybe a month earlier, his sixth grandchild was born. So, I mean, this was just, you know, a man kind of cut out in the middle of his life. And so I was really shocked by the whole thing and really kind of quite upset. So I expressed this to her. But I said, you know, I do want to go ahead with the article. And so I said, once it's done and published, I will send it to you. So I did. And she came back to me and said, you know, like, you did a nice job in terms of, you know, really kind of getting a good idea of sort of the relationship between Dahmer and Kennedy. And she said, you know, I'd like you to just take the notes, take everything that Pat lent you or gave to you, and just do whatever you can with it. So it took a couple of years to kind of sort of put it all together. I mean, it's all Patrick's voice, but I mean, there was just some areas that needed to be kind of, you know, organized and coordinated and something fleshed out. There was quite a bit of the personal life part of his story that I thought, man, you know, let's just stick with this investigation. So I cut that out. And yeah, basically just really wanted to kind of tell the whole story of Dahmer, but also to use it as an opportunity to be a bit of a legacy to Kennedy as well. So just at the back, there's a little bit of a very brief bio about Patrick's life and legacy. And yeah, just basically, it kind of just all kind of came together. Initially, I had some help, and this book did come out initially in 2016 with the title Dahmer Detective. But it was very, very small print runs, but a lot of demand for it. A lot of people contacting me and saying, I'd love to get my hands on a copy of that book if it's possible. And just through some mutual friends that are into true crime and really read a lot of it, I was able to connect with the fantastic folks at Wild Blue Press, and they took a look at it and said, yeah, we'll reissue it for sure. So that's how that all kind of came about. And that came about very quickly. Like, it was just earlier this year that I had sent them some stuff with the idea of, hey, would you guys like to do something with this? That they came back and said, absolutely. And I think also, too, being the 30th anniversary, there's also the Netflix film that's going to be coming out, I think, next year about Dahmer, like an episodic show about Dahmer. So, it's amazing to me that, there's still so much interest in this story, but there really is. There's a lot of people who are quite fascinated by Dahmer, interested to know more about him and try to figure out, like, why he was the way he was. I don't know if this book helps to that extent, but certainly by having access to somebody that really did get to know Dahmer very well and talk about his crimes and sort of what happened there, I think that's an important part of Patrick's story. And I didn't want it to not have anything happen to it because he passed away. I said, there's no reason why his story can't still come out. So I made it kind of a personal labor of love mission to just get Patrick's story out there any way I could.
Absolutely. It's an extraordinary look at one of the most brilliant police investigations ever, and one of the most important ones, given the gravity of everything and what was at stake. Because if a lawyer might have been able to speak to him, especially given that the DNA, without his cooperation, there's just no way this story would have been told, but also the identification of many of those victims. It's also a glowing tribute to Patrick, all of his police work, but and also just a tribute to what he was able to gain from Jeffrey Dahmer. And now this book, Grilling Dahmer, is – and for all those people that think they know about the Jeffrey Dahmer story, without this interrogation and without Patrick Kennedy's interrogation, we would not get to realize so many of the things that we now believe and know about Jeffrey Dahmer. So I think this is essential reading, Grilling Dahmer, for anybody that thinks they know the entire story. So I want to thank you very much, Robin Maharaj, for coming on and talking about your new book, Grilling Dahmer, The Interrogation of the Milwaukee Cannibal, on Wild Blue Press. And just tell us where they might take a look at this, and also when is the release date?
Well, it's coming out later this year. I don't know if I have the exact release date, but people can actually order the ebook, and that's available on Amazon. And they can also go right through the publisher, so wildbluepress.com. And I think Amazon, and it'll be available, I'm sure, in bookstores. And it'll be out there.
And the ebook is available right now.
It is available now. Yeah.
Okay. I want to thank you very much, Robin Maharaj, Grilling Dahmer, The Interrogation of the Milwaukee Cannibal. It's a brilliant book. Thank you so much for this interview. You have a great evening. Good night.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Take care.
Bye-bye.